So, where were we? Well, in the first quarter of 1963, in Cambodia, Sihanouk, still trying to maintain his grip on power and looking to balance contending external and internal challenges, well, he had reacted in fury to a seemingly spontaneous student rebellion in Siem Reap by blaming his usual enemies. Old politicians barely relevant anymore, and hidden internal communists. He had even thrown his political toys out of the political pram, kicking up a stink and inviting a list of 34 subversives, which was basically a hodgepodge of people on the left and right that were suspected of being vaguely anti-Sihanouk, and for them to, form their own damn government if they thought they were so good. Now, if you remember, my dear listener, there was more than a couple of genuine, high-ranking members of the Kampuchean Workers' Party on that list, including, but not limited to, Salot Sor, aka Pol Pot, and Yang Sari. Pol, in particular, was more than a little spooked at being publicly, exposed in this way, even though it was probably due to he and other secret communists work as prominent leftist school teachers rather than via intelligence on their real revolutionary positions. But a reason to maybe think they had been exposed is because, well, this wasn't that long after the former leader of their movement and part of the elder generation of the Cambodians who had joined the Indochinese Communist Party, Thu Samut, well, he had been assassinated by Sihanouk's police. So it was a fairly uncomfortable position for the new leadership to be placed in. They make the decision, particularly Pol, to head back into the Makis, the jungle, to develop their proletarian consciousness and build the revolution from under the shadows of the verdant canopies across the border in Vietnam. But this event, this calling out of the list of 34 subversives, is also a good example for us to take a sort of a wider look at what's going on in Cambodian politics here. Like, what is going on? This is at a time when Sihanouk is visiting places like Beijing and on the world stage praising that kind of communist state. But at home, he's trying to clamp down on any kind of internal communist movement. But has also invited a few well-known, he would use the phrase Khmer Rouges, into his Sankum government. This kind of singular, all-encompassing political movement that made up the one-party state under the rule of the former king. The most prominent of these so-called Khmer Rouges was Khieu Samphan, a member of the French Communist Party, a guy who wrote his thesis on a Marxist view of the Cambodian economy, a guy who was basically the archetypal French-educated Cambodian leftist. So we have this kind of landscape at the moment. We have prominent leftists like Samphan in government. We've got members of the Communist Party spread around Cambodia, in the provinces and in Phnom Penh, working in secret cells. We've got some of the leadership in the jungles of Vietnam, hanging out with the National Liberation Front, the NLF or Viet Cong, and there are more conservative parts of Sihanouk's government as well that despise the leftists and wish that Sihanouk, who's at the top of all of this, would stop flirting so much with the communist bloc and get much more comfortable in bed with the West. And of course, meanwhile, all of this is happening, the Buddhists in South Vietnam have started setting themselves on fire in the months which lead up to the collapse of the Diem regime. It is a tense year, all 1963. And I just think it's kind of interesting that there are these competing visions, aren't there? Sort of for how Cambodia should develop as a nation state, having only been independent for what? Less than 10 years at this point? I sort of realized something when I was researching this episode, something that kind of stuck out to me, which is that there is basically, by this point in the early 60s, there's only been one generation of what we might define in the West as politicians. It's basically the same cast of characters that are all still playing. Like even Son Yat-chan, the guy who had the first Khmer language newspaper, this instrumental figure in the development of Khmer nationalism, the first guy to, you know, however briefly, be prime minister, he's still kicking about in the margins, colluding with the US and South Vietnamese to try and undermine Sihanouk. Like, there are conspiracies here. Not conspiracies in the sense of conspiracy theories that we might be familiar with today, but genuine people, groups, conspiring to do things. Some are out there, still living double lives, like Nguyen Chea. Some are just presumed to have these views. And some are quite open about it. Some of these groups, like the Kampuchean Workers' Party, have detailed, you know, dot by dot point documents saying what they are going to do to try and take power in their country. So, as we sort of re-acclimate to this part of the story again, the Cambodian side, I actually want to take a moment or two to discuss, well, the Khmer Rouge. And you might hear that and say, weren't you just doing that, Lachlan? Isn't that sort of the whole thing here? And yes, that is correct. But since I'd brought up Khieu Samphan as this kind of archetypal Khmer Rouge, I kind of want to expand upon that a little bit. As I was able to get this book I'd always wanted, and it finally came in time for me to sort of include it in the discussion. It's called Cambodian Communism and the Vietnamese Model by Steve Hedder, one of the massive scholars of Cambodian history. His main thesis is one that I've slowly been introducing throughout the series thus far, but it is one that can be considered as slightly, it sort of goes against the standard view that one might have absorbed about the Pol Pot regime just via general osmosis. His argument is that the Communist Party of Kampuchea, the CPK, as they will eventually settle on calling themselves, was a movement that almost step by step used the blueprint pretty much provided to them by the Indochinese Workers' Party, which we can just basically say was the Vietnamese communists. We've gone over this in previous episodes, like I said, but it will be a very prominent theme in this episode, and as we head into the Cambodian Civil War and the subsequent regime of Democratic Kampuchea. The relationship with the Vietnamese, as it has been for the entire series, is a major facet of the story. Now that goes a little against the idea that it was three or four highly educated Cambodians who went to France, came back, and initiated the most violent revolution the region has ever seen, based on their own ideology and no one else's. But to relate it back to, well, the terms of this name, Khmer Rouge, like I've said it dozens of times throughout the series so far, it's probably the most evocative two words in combination in terms of its weight in this story. It's probably something you heard way before you listened to my retelling of this history. It is the tip of the spear in terms of what it conjures up. Everything from Pol Pot, the killing fields, black pajama-clad teenagers with steely expressions, red and white scarves around their necks. The two words, when uttered, evoke dread, disaster, famine, sickness, violence, and much, much else. There is a good chance that when you hear the words Khmer Rouge, the first image that comes to mind is literally a pile of skulls. Now, naturally, that wasn't always the case. It goes without saying that the Khmer Rouge would have to commit the crimes they are famous for committing before they'd be associated with the crimes. But if we sort of take it backwards here, it wasn't until the 1970s that Khmer Rouge became a kind of catch-all epithet for the entire Cambodian communist movement. The CPK are never calling themselves Khmer Rouge. It's people outside of that movement who use the phrase. And certainly when it comes to the attention of the West, you know, before, during, and after the regime takes power, the phrase does a lot to communicate who you were talking about. It goes without saying that the phrase literally means Red Cambodians, and it originally started popping up in the late 50s in these early attempts at political pluralization in a newly independent Cambodia. It relates to the political spectrum, obviously, like someone saying a person is a lefty or a conservative. And if we tease that out slightly in a modern context, there was the term that came out of the United States in and around, 2015, which was the alt-right, which meant a kind of specific ideology in comparison to someone who was just on that conservative side of the political spectrum. You could say the same for the difference between someone who identified themselves as having liberal political views or progressive political views and someone who was going around as a, you know, self-proclaimed Marxist or Maoist. Like, obviously that sort of signifies a specific place on that political spectrum. So when Sihanouk starts saying Khmer Rouges in the 1950s, he has quite a specific kind of person in mind. Basically, it's someone like Khieu Sampan, a French-educated communist who is supposedly rather independent from those Cambodians who had essentially joined up with the Vietnamese communists to fight the French, the so-called Khmer Viet Minh. That's why Khmer's Rouges evokes that kind of French intellectual sort of feeling. I'll quote Heder here on this point. According to the prince's dichotomy, the Khmer Viet Minh were more accomplices of the Vietnamese communists, under whose orders they acted to subvert Cambodia and open the way for it to be colonized and swallowed by Vietnam. The Khmer Rouge, Sihanouk said, also supported the Vietnamese communists against their own government by trying to advance Marxism in Cambodia, but were more independent-minded. End quote. So what he's highlighting there is Sihanouk's own conception, where he thought that there were two kinds of Cambodian communist. Those that were 100% with the Vietnamese and were just trying to open up the country for Vietnamese domination, and those that were Marxist Cambodians who just wanted to advance communism but were actually a little bit different in their final aims for what they wanted to accomplish, quite a bit more separate from the Vietnamese. Now, as we know, Sihanouk wasn't exactly privy to the actual goings-on and conspiring of the Khmer Workers' Party, or prior to that name change, the Khmer People's Revolutionary Party, or to what they were most commonly referring to themselves as, simply UNKA, the organization. There wasn't really this delineation between the so-called Khmer Rouge and the so-called Khmer Viet Minh. It was all really more of a mixed bag. There were some straight-up intellectuals like Yang Sari and Son Sen, as well as Khieu Sampan, but then there were old-school Issarak like Sao Pim, and to a lesser extent Nuon Chea and Tam Mok, who had never set foot in France. Then there was someone like Salot Sar, who sort of straddled the line between the two supposed sides, a little bit less educated than someone like Yang Sari, but who had more hands-on experience in the marquees, like those who had been in the Indochinese Communist Party fighting the French. He's a little Khmer Rouge and a little Khmer Viet Minh. He linked both worlds, even though that distinction really doesn't hold much explanatory value. There really was just a Cambodian revolutionary communist movement. But Heder actually goes on to explain the reason why this false dichotomy was occupying Sihanouk. And the reason is it was to a large extent a function, a result of the Khmer communist conspiracy. But perhaps I'm getting into the historical weeds again here, folks. So let me orient back toward where we are at in sort of early to mid 1963 in Cambodia. And I want to keep these ideas about, you know, the idea of the Khmer Rouge compared to the reality of that movement. I want to keep that front and center. And I don't think there is a better way of exemplifying that than between two fairly different characters who will become pivotal to the story. The differing roles here of Khieu Sampan and Nuon Chea at this time. We've met both of these guys in the series so far, but I'll say this again too. Sometimes it's hard to get a grasp on names and the who's who. So when it comes to those that will form, you know, significant parts of the leadership of the regime, dare I say even those who will end up being held most accountable for the crimes of the regime, I'm sort of comfortable repeating some things just in order for the listener to familiarize with these people in particular. And again, if you want to go that bit further, you can check out the website where we do have photos and names of people if you want to keep that in your mind's eye. Either way, Khieu Sampan and Nuon Chea, they represent two quite different roads to the Cambodian communist movement. Sampan was always an active student. He went to the Lycée Sisawat, he studied mathematics in Cambodia, and then law and economics. He too went to France for higher education, just a year or two after Salat Sar. He took over the Marxist circle after Ieng Sary went back to Cambodia. So he was very much part of that group, that Paris-educated group. He started his own kind of newspaper when he also came back to Phnom Penh, one that got him beaten up by some of the conservative politicians in Sihanouk's government. But eventually, he was encouraged by Sihanouk to join the parliament, along with two other prominent young leftist intellectuals, Hua Yuan and Hua Nim. Interestingly, Sampan's thesis sort of builds upon some of the contentions of his fellow leftist French-educated comrades here, and one of the main thrusts of his dissertation is that Cambodia must end its external dependencies before it could develop from an agrarian to an industrial economy. Something quite important in terms of what the CPK will eventually do while in power, in search of autarky, or as they will call it, independence mastery. Anyway, by 1963, by the time Sihanouk was calling him and the rest of the 34 subversives into his office for a stern talking to, Sampan had been Secretary of State for Commerce for more than half a year. His policies were around austerity, increased taxes on luxury items, and lessening the burden on the poorer strata of society. He had been brought in by Sihanouk as a kind of, maybe some of these young smart guys can help fix the economy. And if they can't, well, I can just blame them for not fixing it anyway. Win-win. But conservatives and those on the right of the Sankum Party strongly opposed the measures of this young leftist intellectual. This is one of the peculiarities of having this one massive party that encompassed both the left and the right. Anyway, what is kind of an oddity about Sampan as well is that he was so out there, like a very prominent figure. There is some contention in the historical record about exactly when he properly joined the Khmer Workers' Party. Some members say that he joined in 1963. He himself says it wasn't until the late 60s. But what is more interesting about him is that regardless of how connected he was to the sort of standing committee of the party, he was always playing this auxiliary role for it. This function of being in parliament had many uses. Hedder contends that this kind of progressive presence in the Sankum allowed for the real Communist Party to exert influence on Sihanouk and society, pushing them toward anti-imperialism and shaping a progressive opinion. This gave the so-called Angkar, the organization, a, quote, credible, albeit misleading, public face, suggesting it was under their control, end quote. What he's saying there is that having these prominent, essentially openly communist faces in the positions in the parliament, Well, it gave the public the impression that these prominent leftists in government, that they were the actual leaders of the Cambodian communists, rather than simply a tool of a secretive, hidden, real leadership. These public-facing intellectuals like Sampan, well, they're also broadcasting a fairly benign brand of communist messaging, campaigning for social justice, democratic rights, and a better standard of living, which is just a few shades lighter than the kind of armed and violent revolution that was shrouded by the real leadership's secrecy, like the stuff the other guy I want to talk about is cooking up. So, Nuon Chea, who will eventually become the so-called brother number two, let's have a quick recap on him as well, yeah? Although I might as well point out here that although many history books that reference figures like Pol Pot and Nuon Chea will reference them as brother number one and brother number two, respectively, Nuon Chea himself said while on trial that they actually didn't use these names. So I don't know. Take whichever side of that you feel persuasive. Anyway, he was born in Battambang, which is the province in the west, neighbouring Thailand. He was basically the same age as Pol Pot. He goes to high school in Battambang, then completed a degree in Bangkok, and went on to continue studying a law degree. He continues working in Thailand, and in his early 20s, joins something called the Thai Democratic Youth League, basically a communist-led organization. And it's around this time he also spends a period in a Buddhist monastery. It was in 1950, however, that he became a full rights member of the Thai Communist Party and then travelled back to Cambodia to fight against the French in the early stages of the First Indochina War. Eventually, he will transfer into the Indochinese Communist Party, and he even attended the conference in 1951 when it was split into the three separate entities along national lines, like the Cambodian, Vietnamese, and Laotian parties. By the end of the war, he will have trained in North Vietnam, studying communist principles and militia warfare. Now, it was after Geneva when he returned to Cambodia. Remember, the majority of Cambodian communists didn't. They actually stayed in North Vietnam, and it was only a kind of, how would you put it, sort of a skeleton crew that did come back to Cambodia and tried to organize the early movement after the war was over. And that's when he begins taking on some much more important roles. He was related to one of the two in charge in this period. Remember, there was Thu Samut, who we discussed earlier, and Siu Heng. Now, they were going to run the Cambodian side of things, while the old leader, Son Nhoc Minh, stayed in North Vietnam. Nuon Chea was kind of related to Siu Heng via marriage to one of Siu Heng's cousins, I believe. And once he defected to the government, there was a few that became a little suspicious of Nuon Chea's association with him. This has actually been used by a couple of historians to explain why it was that Salot Sar became leader of the party after Thu Samut was assassinated. As well, Nuon Chea would have actually been the logical next person in line. So there is perhaps a little camaraderie there between the number one and number two there, like a deal being struck by Pol saying, look, I know you're fine, and I know that it was supposed to be you next in line, but a couple of people have their suspicions, not me. It looks like I'll need to take the lead, but I'm going to keep you in the loop. I'm going to keep you as my number two. We're going to work together on this. Stick with me. I believe it was the historian Henry Locard who will describe this relationship between Nuon Chea and Pol Pot as being a sort of the two separate sides of the same brain when it comes to the leadership of the party. So I do want you to have these guys much closer together in terms of their power than you may have already presumed with what you knew about the Khmer Rouge beforehand. Anyway, by the early 60s, Nuon Chea is definitely doing the double life thing, like many of the Cambodian communists had been. But he isn't teaching like some of the other party members. He sort of has this deep undercover thing going on as a Cambodian member of a sort of Sino-Khmer trading company. So again, very untypical compared to, say, Khieu Samphan, who's, you know, just being a politician who's openly leftist, or someone like Yang Sari, who's being a teacher, but is obviously, you know, all of his students would basically know that he's a communist. These are the guys that got quite into politics in Cambodia, then went to France and came back committed Marxists. Nguyen Chea is almost the opposite of that. A native communist, if that phrase makes any sense. He was born and bred in Cambodia and Thailand and Vietnam, and that's where he learned his skills. But the difference between he and, in this instance, Khieu Samphan, is quite instructive here. Samphan is out and about, preaching, catching the ire of the political conservatives. And it really isn't that close to the leadership of the party at all. There's conjecture about whether he's even part of the party at this time, although he is a tool of it. Meanwhile, Nguyen Chea, who really is the most, you know, reclusive of the future leadership. I mean, all the books you read on him will generally at some point say, we really don't know much about this guy. He was always in the shadows, pulling strings, making things happen. Mild-mannered businessman by day, secret revolutionary by night. And no one would have suspected it. And when we talk about what Nguyen Chea is doing in this period, especially after Pol Pot, Yang Sari, and Son Sen, and then sort of after that, a regular sort of train of others start secretly heading back to the Marquis as well. Well, Nguyen Chea kind of becomes the de facto manager of the party in Cambodia. Not only is he sort of setting up many of the ways in which the members will actually get across the border and join the leadership in the Marquis, but he himself is visiting them for meetings, sharing information. The guy that never studied in France, that was there from the start with the Thai Issarak movement, who was studying communism in North Vietnam, not the Rue Letellier, in the shadows, old school Khmer Viet Minh. So much so that later on in the story, the Vietnamese will be far more trusting of their former student than perhaps they should have been. They will think he was their guy, and he is not. But we'll get there eventually. So at this point, sort of 1963, 1964, going into 1965, we've got Nguyen Chea organising the movement in Cambodia, with input from the leadership in the Marquis. But we've been building to this for a while, haven't we? There was the organising of sympathetic students and student groups by the teachers like Yang Sari, Son Sen, Pol Pot, then workers in, say, the rail industry, or you might be able to make inroads into some intellectual circles via the example that someone like Khieu Samphan was setting in public, in government. So they had networks in the countryside, networks capable of communicating with the leadership in the jungles, and in contact with the Vietnamese. Slowly but surely, this sort of, well, not sure how much this happens in, I don't know, wherever you might be listening from, my dear listener. But when I grew up in the semi-rural countryside of Australia, sometimes you would walk to your front door at night, having just walked through that same path a few hours ago in the afternoon, and when you are completely oblivious, I mean, what are you doing? You're walking to your front door, you've done it 1,000 times, no problem. So you're walking to the front door, it's at night, out of nowhere, you've got a giant orb spider's web all over your face and the spider somewhere crawling around the back of your hair. I can say from experience that once you get that spider in your face a couple of times, you definitely start to suspect there might be spiders everywhere, even if you can't see them. That's sort of what we've been building to for a while, haven't we? Slowly, the Cambodian communists have been building this network, this web across the entire country. And Nguyen Chea himself will describe the secret operations necessary to build this web, to build this revolution. And he is quoted in Philip Short's biography of Pol Pot. I'll quote it at length here. Our organization had the following rules. 3 members are required to form a cell. If there are more than 3 people, we form 2 separate cells, having no contact with each other. If the enemy discovers one, the other can continue its work. In each factory or school or university, there is one leading cadre. Only he knows this. Contact between him and the leadership is organized through a third person, and if the enemy catches the leading cadre, he cannot identify the leadership. Only the go-between. Our couriers are not allowed to know our real places of residence, otherwise captured couriers could be forced to reveal them. We have learned to abandon a safe house if a messenger is 2 or 3 hours late. We have had some bitter experience with these things. End quote. So like I said, slowly and through these painstakingly secretive methods, the Cambodian communists are building this invisible web. The government might know there are spiders somewhere hiding, but they can't see this web that is being spun in secret across the entire country. And in connection to those in the east in the jungles of Vietnam's border. And I suppose it's about time we checked in on the leadership after their clandestine return to the marquees. Particularly as South Vietnam began to burn not long after they arrived at the Viet Cong camp in early 1963. So while Nguyen Chea was organizing the party in Phnom Penh and the countryside and which courier was going where and which in-between was talking to which cadre where, about 250 kilometers away, or about 150 miles for those inclined, we have 3 men sitting in a circle on the ground under a canopy of jungle so thick that it barely let light shine through it. Just over the border from Cambodia to South Vietnam, looking pallid and a little malnourished, were Pol Pot, Yang Sari, and Son Sen, all of whom probably feeling quite a ways from their homes in the city, let alone the distant memories they all shared of the streets of Paris. They had been in this jungle encampment for weeks now, and were getting a little fed up with their hosts and comrades, the NLF, whose headquarters were not far away. It's like, have you ever turned up to a party thinking you were going to have a great night, and that you were going to know everyone there, and then you arrive and it's just not working. No one is really talking, you feel quite awkward, and realize you don't actually know anyone. Everyone seems content to just talk about work that you are unfamiliar with, and there is no food or drink. That is sort of the vibe I get from reading about the Cambodian communist leadership when they arrive at this camp in the jungle. A few peasant huts scattered around a forest with a system of bunkers and tunnels. One South Vietnamese revolutionary who was in and around this area at a similar time recalled being constantly hungry, that they only received about 20 kilos of rice per month, which left them in a state of, quote, semi-starvation, that they were always looking for a little extra protein here or there, and that a particular kind of jungle moth, wings removed and quickly cooked over a flame, wasn't that bad. And if you'll recall, my dear listener, Salot Sa, Pol Pot, had already done this kind of thing about 10 years earlier at the end of the First Indochina War, joining up with those Khmer Viet Minh who were supporting the Vietnamese. Much like that whole time, the Cambodians again kind of existed in this setting on a lower level, lower than their hosts, that is. They were instructed to never leave the camp or go to the nearby villages. They were allowed to listen to the radio once a week, and they had meetings with the Viet Cong who caught them up on the various goings-on in the region. This was like going to that party, and not only is it a bit awkward and boring, but as a grown adult, you're told that you actually need to go and have a seat at the kids' table, and not to drink any alcohol. But as Philip Short points out, At this moment, the Khmer revolutionaries actually see themselves as equal to their Vietnamese comrades. This treatment is just a little on the nose for them. They're not students anymore. They're the leaders of a national communist movement. There is this feeling for the leadership, particularly for the rest of 1963, that they are just sort of in limbo. Remember, the North Vietnamese and the NLF as well, they've always urged caution and passivity for their Cambodian comrades. They are broadly quite all right with having Sihanouk in charge, as he broadly aligns with their current goals. They've always said, yeah, look guys, just cool it on the calls for armed struggle. You aren't quite up to that yet. Don't worry, once we have our country united, we will help you guys do the same in the name of communism. But just for the moment, sit down and take a beat, okay? So with an increasing amount of those in the Khmer leadership who really do want to start an armed struggle, who really do think they are ready, it grates on them that at this time they must have begrudgingly realized that they were largely incapable of doing so without the help of the Vietnamese. I mean, at its simplest, the Cambodian communists don't have any guns, and you need those. In fact, David Chandler characterizes the time the leadership spends in the marquees as being under the protection of the Vietnamese for 8 years. But just because the leadership are sort of in limbo at this moment and not, you know, waging an armed struggle yet, doesn't mean that there's not a lot of important things that come out of this period in the marquees, but particularly for, say, the ideology that will inform, you know, their time in power when that time does come. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on that, but I just want to sort of frame that. Like, imagine, yeah, you've got these guys just sitting in the jungle, sort of bored, not really connected to anything anymore. But can you imagine, like, I would have been absolutely fascinated to have been able to see the meeting, you know, in this dark forest where the five or six Cambodians would have been summoned by their Viet Cong handler to come and hear the news that Diem had been assassinated. What a moment, right? You know, not getting that on TV or the radio. And then not 3 weeks later to see the meeting when they were also summoned and informed that the US president had also been assassinated. What a thing, right? All of the sources I've got don't detail how the Cambodians reacted to this news. I did have a good look, but in reality, it'll actually be Sihanouk's reaction to both Diem and Kennedy's death that will cause the most trouble. But as I said, we'll get there at the end of the episode. But for now, toward the end of 1963, further crackdowns by, you know, Sihanouk's government against the communists will sort of necessitate that a steadily increasing number of them do start arriving at this same jungle encampment to join the leadership. And a result of that, eventually Pol will persuade their Viet Cong hosts to allow them to have their own separate Cambodian camp. This base will be known as Office 100. And in something that will come up again and again as the story goes on, this is both, you know, a physical place, like you can imagine a sign saying this is Office 100, although that wasn't the case, but you know what I mean, like this area is Office 100. But it will also be a code name for the leadership itself, so you could both physically visit Office 100 as well as have a meeting with Office 100. But just because they had their own office doesn't mean they were independent. Nai Saran, a revolutionary who came to the camp in August, summed up how this worked in relation to their hosts. Quote, "We had to rely on the Vietnamese for everything. Food, materials, security, the lot. To go from one bureau to another, we had to have a Vietnamese guard escort us. They were the hosts and we had to obey. But in terms of policy and ideology, little by little, we were developing an independent stance." End quote. Now, by the end of this series, you are going to be sick of hearing about independence, mastery, and self-reliance. But the sheer weight that the Cambodian communists give these goals gives you a sense of just how important they felt that it was. Like, if we follow Hedder's thinking here, that the CPK will essentially just be following the blueprint for revolution handed to them by the Vietnamese, well, the degree to which the leadership conceded that they were doing this and will want to prove that they can do this on their own and better, or that there was a degree of self-deception, a kind of delusion of grandeur where they hadn't really internalized just how much of their movement was guided by the former Indochinese Communist Party, will be quite interesting. And as I said, this idea of independence mastery will really be baked in to the Cambodian communists' ideology. And it's the ideology I actually want to discuss quite a bit here, because it's when they have Office 100 and it's when Nguyen Chea is regularly coming to visit to have meetings with Pol Pot. It's where they decide on policy and direction, what they will call the party line, which will be another phrase that will be on heavy rotation throughout the rest of the series. They will call what is known as a plenum of the Central Committee in early 1964, which is basically a meeting where all of the leaders come and codify the kinds of decisions that were being made by the top of the leadership. Remember, the principle of democratic centralism that Lenin introduced to us in the Soviet Union many episodes back. This kind of, well, it was explained once by David Chandler with reference to the Khmer Rouge leadership as, sure, there was always some discussion, but at the end of the day, it was basically what either Pol Pot or Nguyen Chea decided upon that everyone else would end up going along with. So that's their version of democratic centralism. And it's at this Central Committee meeting, which took place over a few weeks, where some of the foundations of the movement were being laid. The resolution that was penned there emphasized all forms of struggle, including armed violence, against Sihanouk's government, and they emphasized this need for self-reliance, which Philip Short suggests, as we said just before, he suggests that this was the CPK code word for freedom from Vietnamese control. Self-reliance. So remember that. Anyway, we have Pol Pot's own words to consult about this period of time when the Cambodian communist leaders will formulate an ideology, a worldview, this party line which will be imbued into the rank and file, the political energy which will in the near future animate their revolution, their war, their struggle, and perhaps even each swing of some blunt object into the skull of hundreds of thousands, if not a million, people who will be violently killed by the regime. One prominent slogan heard throughout democratic Kampuchea after their communist victory in 1975 can be translated into English as such. Smash one statue of Buddha and you will gain one sack of cement. Now, considering what we know about the ideological influence on who I will out of ease refer to as the Khmer Rouge, this iconoclastic and socialist messaging makes quite a bit of sense, doesn't it? It's generally anti-religious, it's focused on hard work and making progress, it's the revolution above all else, right? And we've traced the kind of influences that would underpin that standard socialist reading of that slogan throughout the series so far. Whether it was via the European political thought of Marxism and Leninism, with leaders in the party such as, you know, Yang Sari uncovering the Communist Manifesto before joining the French Communist Party during their studies in Paris, or even someone like Pol Pot who read the works of Stalin, Now, we've also seen how Mao's influence was felt by these young men and women via his writings as well, particularly the focus on the mass movement of the peasantry and new democracy and things like that. Now, academics, historians, scholars, and journalists have also shown us how other ideological formations were influencing this leadership group, the Khmer Communists, like Philip Short suggesting the French Revolution and its events being taught in Cambodian schools would figure into their worldview, or someone like Ben Kiernan claiming that the racism inherent in Vichy France or the xenophobic relationship between Cambodia and Vietnam will also play a similar ideological role. We've also alluded to someone like Steve Hedder just recently, who has shown how the Vietnamese communists, with their particular brand of revolution, essentially gave birth to the Cambodian movement and the first Cambodian communists, pretty much guiding it forwards from that early point. Now, those are all very... well, I haven't used this metaphor in a while, but those are kind of the cool foreign winds and dynamic pressure systems that are slowly contributing to the coming historical hurricane. These will also take the form of events and settings too. We've spent a lot of time now on, say, the wars in Indochina, or the influence of US foreign policy on the region too. More of that to come. But what about some more of the Cambodian influence? The warm, moist air, and its contribution to that historical hurricane. Well, to return to that slogan I said before, smash one statue of Buddha and you will gain one sack of cement, given everything we know so far, and what you, my dear listener, probably already know about democratic Kampuchea, about the Pol Pot regime, the banning of money, the closing of markets, the disintegration of religion. Well, that slogan makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Well, having got this far in the series, and having Pol Pot in the jungle, Nuon Chea coming to visit every now and again, and deciding the direction of the party, formulating their ideology in this important period in the first half of the 60s, I would like to present to you perhaps a somewhat incongruous suggestion, that one of the most iconoclastic regimes in modern history also heavily utilized one of the institutions it sought to destroy in order to facilitate their ideology to their revolutionary movement. And it's in this period, in the jungles, that I feel that this was imprinted upon their worldview. I'm going to suggest that Buddhist thinking, language, and grammar will be one of the most important ways in which communist concepts are transplanted into Cambodian minds. Now, to show this, to explore this, we can look at the writings of the party once they were in power. Now, in any sort of walk of life, I always feel it's useful to listen to what people are actually saying rather than simply telling them what you think they're saying. For instance, an October 1976 issue of Revolutionary Young Men and Women, the counterpart to Revolutionary Flag, which was the party magazine that they began printing in and around the early 1960s, and throughout their time in power. Anyway, this particular issue proclaimed, quote, "From the very beginning, the party determined to take the work of political consciousness as the most important work of all," end quote. Now, as Alex Hinton writes in Why Did They Kill, quote, "The Khmer Rouge often discussed political consciousness using the term Satyarama," end quote. This term, Satyarama, is going to do a lot of work, at least in my humble opinion, based on what I think is the most compelling work of other, more qualified historians, that is. Satyarama, the Khmer Rouge understanding of political consciousness. To me, this is the key to understanding their revolution, their ideology, and in the end, their conceptions of a new society that will invert the normal hierarchy, promulgate their ideas of who is and who isn't a pure revolutionary, and in the end, who will be deemed necessary to sweep clean. So let's look at this term in more detail, particularly how it should be thought of within a Cambodian context, as opposed to other socialist revolutions and their similar use of the phrase class consciousness. I say, as I hear the reviewer's remarks on my undergrad thesis ringing in my head. I don't have a word limit now, so I can talk about this all I want, and you can't stop me. Anyway, if we break the word up, the Khmer Arama has the specific Buddhist connotation of perception, to distinguish or comprehend something, which can be related to the Theravada concept of the five aggregates, a kind of differentiation between the senses of the mind that altogether condition life. If you have ever practiced mindfulness meditation, perhaps some of these concepts will grab you, more or less. But without getting too deep into Theravada Buddhist metaphysics, we can speak about Satyarama as mindful consciousness. That is, a consciousness where one is recognizing, remembering, thinking, and acting in an attentive and aware manner. It also smuggles in the wider Buddhist conceptions of reality based on the Buddha's teachings, the Dhamma. So to possess a mindful consciousness, you would also be thinking and acting in a way that is based upon an understanding of the correct Buddhist worldview. Now, when the Khmer Rouge start using the term Satyarama, they give it a different meaning, but one that absolutely brings with it the kind of Buddhist valence that a Cambodian would recognize. Their version of Satyarama meant revolutionary consciousness, or in some translations, proletarian consciousness. So what the heck is proletarian consciousness? Well, if you cast your mind back to some of the episodes that dealt with the rise of communist thinking, the proletariat were basically the industrial working class, identified by Marx and Engels as the backbone of the revolutionary class war that would see them overturn their oppressors and build socialism based on a dictatorship of the proletariat. Nothing to lose but your chains, workers of the world unite, etc., etc. Now, since I've got you remembering, it's also probably worth mentioning here the way that the peasantry was thought of in this orthodox Marxist worldview. To put it lightly, they weren't thought of in glowing terms. The industrial proletariat represented progress, the peasantry, backwardness. For orthodox Marxists, and I'll quote Philip Short here, for the peasantry to develop proletarian characteristics, its role in society would have to change in ways that could only come from the transformation of its economic role. End quote. All right, now before I lose you, what we are talking about here are just class roles, okay? Like in this worldview, a poor subsistence farmer and a factory worker and someone who owns three factories, these three people all occupy different class roles and are thought to have very different parts to play in the Marxist conception of class struggle and revolution and historical progress. So that's the proletarian part of proletarian consciousness. But how does the consciousness part get related? Well, think about the stage that the Cambodian communists are at in the first half of the 1960s. They've been steadily building their movement for about a decade. They have a leadership committed to armed struggle and are creating networks across the country. But one rather large thing that they are missing, as we've just kind of talked about, is a presence within the country's admittedly very small industrial working class. Philip Short touches on this, explaining that one reason may have been that across all of the leadership, all of them, none of them had a working class background. They were either peasants, students of peasant origin, or both. In fact, by the mid-1960s, their inability to create large networks within this, as we said, classically Marxist-Leninist economic class, will eventually be blamed by the leadership on this small industrial class. They must have already been overrun by enemy agents, which again, as Short suggests, will be an example of grim foreshadowing, Whenever anything goes wrong for the Khmer Rouge, it's always enemy agents. That's going to be the lever that is generally pulled in order to explain any circumstance that doesn't work out perfectly for them. But in any case, Q Sampan himself would explain how their movement, again, a communist movement, which generally speaking is supposed to be all about the industrial working class, well, he explains how they were able to disregard this feature to some extent. Quote, "It is true that the Cambodian Communist Party was based on the poor peasantry rather than the working class. But you can't use that as an argument for saying it wasn't a Marxist party, or that there was no economic basis for a communist party in Cambodia. In fact, we applied the criterion of material conditions quite correctly, because the poor peasants were the most impoverished, the most oppressed class in Cambodian society, and it was this class that was the foundation of the Cambodian party." End quote. So what Sampan is saying is that they based their version of Marxist-Leninist ideology on the class struggle, on what the conditions of Cambodia were. Pol Pot also expands on this, seeking a direction for the movement. Philip Short quotes the future leader of Democratic Kampuchea, reflecting on these formative years in the early 1960s. Quote, "Marxism-Leninism resides within the movements forged by the people, and the people's movement in each country puts together its own Marxism-Leninism. Cambodia is also able to contribute to the building of Marxism-Leninism." And Short quotes him elsewhere as saying, "After 1963, when I withdrew to the countryside, my opinions and my thinking and views changed a lot. Because I was in a very isolated, remote, rural area, far from the city. It was what I saw in the country that made an impression on me." End quote. Now, Short also includes quotes from Pol about them attempting to find a direction without knowing if it was right or wrong, about having no blueprint, but rather using a mixture of influences. Short suggests that while Pol was acknowledging that foreign experiences and other socialist regimes could provide useful lessons, the goal was an authentically Khmer doctrine, rooted in Cambodian identity. What this means, I mean, particularly for me, trying to explain this to you, is that there will be a uniquely Cambodian flavor to their version of a socialist revolution. In the simplest terms, to those who argue that their revolution was lacking the fundamental ingredient, a large industrial working class, well, we can borrow the Leninist idea of having a suitably zealous revolutionary vanguard in the shape of the Communist Party of Kampuchea and their inner leadership, and through culturally informed conceptions of consciousness, reply that rather than having a proletarian class in economic terms, the party would simply impart the need for the revolutionary society to cultivate a proletarian mental state, satyarama, the ability to build this state of mindfulness and consideration of the Communist Party of Kampuchea's political line, in the same way that the regular non-communist satyarama meant a mindful consideration of the Buddha's Dharma. In this sense, the communists replaced the Buddhist framework with a revolutionary socialist one. Alex Hinton gets into this a lot in his book, Why Did They Kill? And I will sort of paraphrase him here. But I want you to compare this general idea of a proletarian consciousness and the need to build socialist traits that would supposedly alleviate social suffering. I mean, how much does that remind you of the Buddhist notion of mindful consciousness enabling you to see the true nature of things, while the ignorance of this leads to suffering? Or more generally, about the Pol Pot regime glorifying a kind of asceticism, detachment, the elimination of attachment and desire, the renunciation of material goods, as well as personal behaviors and attitudes, not to mention the de-emphasis of the individual. All of this shouldn't be that surprising when we consider the cultural context in which their communist movement grew. As Philip Short puts this, quite elegantly in my opinion, quote, In the 1960s, even more than today, religious belief provided the primary value system of ordinary people throughout Southeast Asia. Sa himself had been a Buddhist novice. And I guess I'll add, so too had Nguyen Chea, as we saw before. Okay, I'll continue to quote short. Sorry. The first communists, like Tu Samut and Son Yoke-min, had studied at the Higher Pali Institute. So had younger leaders, like Siet Che and Ta Mok. Both within the party leadership and among the rank and file, the grammar of Theravada Buddhism permeated Khmer communist thought, just as Confucian notions helped to fashion Maoism. In neither country was this a conscious undertaking, but just as Mao had sinified Marxism, Sa gave it a Buddhist tincture. The result, in both cases, was that it ceased to be a foreign transplant and flourished in autochthonous minds. The idea that proletarian consciousness could be forged independent of a person's class origins or economic status became the central pillar of Khmer communism. End quote. Apologies for the long quote there, but I have been waiting to share that particular set of sentences with all of you for about 4.5 years. So I hope it had the desired effect. Now, I know I've used several metaphors to try and explain this over the course of this series so far, but sort of round up a couple of them here. So we've compared communism to a kind of secular religion where new prophets have sought to add to the doctrine, like Lenin, like Stalin, like Mao. Well, why not Pol Pot as well? I believe another time I related it to a kind of ingredient list for a meal, like how many different cultures have different dishes that we might just sort of put under the category of curry. But in each country, they have vastly different flavors and utilize all kinds of more local ingredients to make a specific dish unique to them, even though it's still a curry. It's why I often, if I'm ever asked to explain these things in my personal life, I'll usually say something along the lines of, well, what the Khmer communists did was both unique and not unique. There are echoes from other events, ideologies, isms. But at the same time, it is a uniquely Khmer story as well. And as we've seen, one that has been heavily influenced by the context of that culture and that nation's circumstance and history. And this may be a little too simplistic, but the way I've come to think about this question of the Khmer Rouge and their true ideological underpinnings is simply to ask, well, what did they think they were doing? What were they intending to produce? And I think when you look at their pronouncements, their magazines, their slogans, their speeches, it's rather clear. And all these sources also give us an example of how this idea of proletarian consciousness was conveyed to their fellow revolutionaries. Like if you look at the October 1976 issue of Revolutionary Flag, the article titled, "Sharpen the Consciousness of the Proletarian Class to be as Keen and Strong as Possible," which was probably written by either Pol Pot or Nguyen Chea, we have a document here that is obsessed with class, with building socialism, but generally through the guise of this revolutionary consciousness prescription. It speaks about the need to, quote, build a proletarian class worldview, proletarian class life, build a proletarian class stand regarding thinking, in living habits, in morality, in sentiment, etc. End quote. Now what this revolutionary or proletarian consciousness, what this being the central pillar of Khmer communism means is that it will be essentially the guiding line for how the social hierarchy is structured in revolutionary Cambodia. What I mean by that is that engaging in the kind of behavior that the party was prescribing, these verbal or behavioral cues that showed your engagement with Satyarama, this would determine your social standing. I'm not going to spend too much more time on this in this episode, but if you do any genocide studies, or for that matter, look at most periods of government-sponsored mass death or atrocity crime, you will usually come across the idea of the other, or the binaries between us and them, accompanied by a variety of circumstances and motivations which serve to dehumanize one group by the other to the point that they are deemed necessary to eliminate. There are other themes here which we will look at in later episodes, but I tend to explain this in the case of the Khmer Rouge Revolution in terms of who was a counter-revolutionary, or more basically, who were deemed to be enemies of the regime. So that most basic binary will be between ideal revolutionary and counter-revolutionary. Again, I will explain how that evolves in the relevant episodes, but the reason I've spent so much time explaining, you know, the strings of Cambodian society, the Kasai, the patronage networks in previous episodes, as well as now spending a fair bit of time on this concept of Satyarama, is because both of these will be fundamental in explaining who is a counter-revolutionary and who isn't, and therefore who the regime will komtek, smash, literally to obliterate into pieces. If we have our bearings on this idea of class being a mental attribute, the Cambodian communists will also consider some people in the new revolutionary society to be more or less predisposed to building the consciousness of that ideal revolutionary. They will consider some people uniquely unable to achieve this proletarian consciousness, and a person's capacity for change will be hindered due to their past acquaintances, for instance, their class background, their past experiences. Their mind will be seen to have been infected by non-proletarian thinking to the extent that they are simply unable to be the ideal revolutionary. And there will be different waves of killings and purges, but generally speaking, once their utopian vision for Cambodia began to falter, the upper echelons of the leadership will fall back on their tendency to blame internal enemies, counter-revolutionaries, those who had been unable to assume the proletarian consciousness, Satyarama. And again, in their own words, in that same issue of Revolutionary Flag, in which the party broadcast the kinds of messaging that their cadre were required to imbibe, well, they explained this kind of action. Quote, "For a number of them, we have had results correcting them. A number of them cannot be corrected. The latter continuously seek occasions to oppose the revolution. They represented class contradictions which threatened to subvert the revolution, and they needed to be eradicated." End quote. Now, apart from sounding like something the ghost of Delbert Grady might chillingly say, it does rather explicitly link their ideology, their worldview, to their killings, their mass killings. We will continue to discuss the implications of this as the Khmer Rouge gather more and more of Cambodia's population into zones under their direct control. But here and now, it did seem like the right place to introduce this idea of Satyarama as the future leaders of democratic Kampuchea were coming up with this idea about what their revolution will look like. Still Marxist-Leninist, still borrowing from other revolutions and movements, but authentically Khmer at the same time. And that is where we will leave the Khmer revolutionaries for now, in the jungles of Vietnam, as we look back into Cambodia itself and how Sihanouk will react to the fateful year of 1963 and its fallout. Alright, so if we are looking at Cambodian politics and, well, how much of that we can actually separate from Sihanouk himself by this point in the early 1960s, I would say we can basically characterize the period from sort of 1962 to 1965 as a gradual and then fairly dramatic split with the United States. Like, that's the most important thing to focus on. Now, up until now, you will have no doubt become used to my overuse of the term tightrope and this analogy and Sihanouk's walking of the tightrope and his attempts to remain neutral amongst a tug of war between capitalist and communist states. But we've also been talking about the self-interest that comes with sort of flirting with both sides every now and again in order to maintain aid programs, get generous loans with no strings attached, get military hardware and funds, as well as Sihanouk's own personal grandiose needs of being, welcomed as a dignitary in these states and being treated like the special person he considers himself to be. Now, if you play your cards right, you can get the United States to pay for most of your military budget. You can get the Chinese to give you tens of millions of dollars to spend on whatever you want. And a host of international conferences about the benefits of remaining neutral. You can espouse the virtues of socialism abroad, while at home, mercilessly imprisoning leftist opponents and engaging in the odd extrajudicial killing. You can keep both sides of national politicians sort of in a position where they can't complain by condemning US imperialism and making the left happy, while also taking in plenty of money for your army from Washington and keeping the conservatives with links to the armed forces content. All the while making secret deals with the North Vietnamese that see them favor you staying in power, rather than fully supporting the embryonic Cambodian revolutionaries. Essentially keeping them subdued without even really knowing it. Either way, it is a fairly delicate balance that relies on saying and doing the right thing internationally, as well as mitigating the effect on national politics that these broader pronouncements have. Complicating all of this, of course, is the escalating conflict in neighboring Vietnam. But broadly speaking, there will be three factors which serve as catalysts for this severing of ties with the United States by 1965, something that David Chandler says, quote, had long-term repercussions that were not foreseen by Sihanouk or by most US observers, end quote. Two of these rather influential factors occur in November of 1963, and it might be easy to guess one of those straight away. In Sihanouk's own words, from a semi-biographical book written in 1973 with a well-known leftist and Australian journalist, Wilfred Burchett, titled My War with the CIA, Cambodia's Fight for Survival. Again, remember that it was written 2 years before the Khmer Rouge victory, and whilst Sihanouk had sided with the revolutionaries. Anyway, Sihanouk describes the first factor tellingly. Quote, on November 1 of that year, 1963, my two arch enemies, Ngo Diem and Ngo Dinh Nhu, were assassinated with CIA help. End quote. Now, all context aside, there is something fascinating about hearing someone in all seriousness write, my two arch enemies, in a non-fiction book. But in any case, yes, the fall of the Diem regime just over the border in Saigon would have had alarm bells ringing for Sihanouk. Diem was the supposed ally of the US, the only boy they had in there, and the CIA had given the thumbs up for his removal from power. If, perhaps, short of genuinely approving he and his brother's murder during that coup. But think about it from Sihanouk's perspective. He had been far less cozy with the US. He has been the target of attempts to remove him from power, and even attempts at his life, both with, we will diplomatically say, tangential CIA knowledge. What this definitely signals to Sihanouk is that the US cannot be trusted as an ally, perhaps even if kept at arm's length. Now, somewhat important background context to this huge event of the Diem assassinations is related to this group called the Khmer Serai. Now, we've spoken about them a little bit in the recent Cambodia episodes, but essentially they're a small and loosely assembled political and paramilitary group that seek to undermine Sihanouk's rule, but from a more, I guess we could say, nationalist or well, certainly not socialist political leaning. They are led by the most famous outcast from Cambodian politics, Sonyok Tan, and they have tacit support from the Thai as well as the South Vietnamese, and perhaps just a tiny bit from various US interested parties. And Sihanouk bloody hates them. They've got these radio transmitters set up over the borders, and they are always broadcasting anti-Sihanouk messaging. They are important at this part of the story for two reasons. The first is that Sihanouk uses the demise of the Xiêm regime, the Khmer Serai's primary benefactor, to publicly call on the US to halt these annoying transmissions. Now, the way Sihanouk goes about this is very on brand. He makes a huge speech on the 5th of November, literally days after Xiêm's assassination, and says that if the transmissions do not cease by the end of the year, he will cut off all free world economic aid. This is directly aimed at the US and is saying, hey, during this little break in proceedings, shut down those broadcasts or else I'm not going to play with you anymore. Now you can imagine that even the most interested United States diplomats, Asia watchers, foreign policy experts, and anyone else under those large branches, that this sort of speech might have gone just a little unnoticed in relation to the absolute shitshow that was the aftermath of Xiêm's murder. This is very much like your cat asking for food at the same time you've got a home intruder. So while Sihanouk is furiously pointing his finger at the Khmer Serai and asking the United States to do something about this, there is also a background of economic malaise, and his desire to see Cambodia have more independence in its economic activity, more national self-sufficiency. We will return to the details of this in a moment, but it's sufficient to say that Sihanouk was worried about becoming a client state dependent on US aid. And not long after his speech calling for them to sort out the Khmer Serai broadcasts, he also announces sweeping economic reforms that include nationalizing Cambodia's import and export industry, the banks, as well as curbing the import of luxury goods. He also signals the renunciation of US economic aid. I feel like I'm spinning a few plates here, but a lot of stuff happens in November. And something like 2 weeks after Xiêm's assassination, we've got another event to mull over. Something a bit dark, in fact, something that shows Sihanouk's dark side, without going into too much detail. Two of these Khmer Serai operatives are captured inside Cambodia. Now, it seems that they had actually been under the impression that they'd basically been invited in, or if not invited to speak with Sihanouk, that they had at least gained permission from a governor in Takeo to do so. So they were then under the impression, basically, that they weren't doing anything wrong. No dice. Sihanouk sees to it that they are arrested in that state, in rather blunt fashion, and brought straight to Phnom Penh. What happens next is kind of sad. On the 19th of November, Sihanouk calls a special national congress to show off his new prisoners. Their names are Priap In and Sang San. Now, at this special national congress, Sihanouk has both prisoners displayed in cages and has them subjected to inquisition by the delegates present. In his own words, again written in that 1973 book, quote, "I called a special session of the national congress to hear Priap In," that he actually doesn't mention that there's two prisoners, "and for him in turn to listen to the vox populi. Faced with reality as expressed by delegate after delegate, he admitted that he had been sadly misled by the CIA. But backing down was not enough. We had difficulty preventing the delegates from lynching him. For years he had plotted against us. Much innocent blood had been spilled by the Khmer Serai commandos. The unanimous opinion of this National Congress was that he should be handed over to a military tribunal. He was condemned to death, and in his case, I had no inhibitions in signing the death warrant. He was shot." End quote. So that's how Sihanouk recalled this. Basically, a traitor to him personally and to the country, who was definitely in cahoots with the CIA, and someone who waltzed into Cambodia to demand Sihanouk step down from power, who was so guilty that it was easy to sign his death warrant, and he was lucky that we didn't kill him then and there on the stage. Well, let's see how this story is told from a couple of other perspectives. Like I said just before, other histories simply have the two Khmer Serai entering Cambodia under the impression that they were allowed to, and were seeking to talk to Sihanouk. Notice in Sihanouk's version that they are not put in cages, by the way. But in both Chandler and Osborne's retelling of this sad tale, that is apparent. And in this other version, basically one of them put to questioning, Priyap In, is said to be in shock the entire time and actually remains completely silent. The other, Saing San, when questioned, does confirm that there are transmitters in Thailand and South Vietnam, and he's basically let free once he confirms this fact. Priyap In, who doesn't speak, and is eventually descended upon by hundreds of spectators who come onto the stage and basically start hitting him with rubber sandals and abuse until, as Sihanouk says, he is taken to a military tribunal for his trial. Now, Chandler says that there was almost no evidence that came from the trial being published. And once the death sentence was handed out, perhaps the most troubling scene also emerged. Quite literally. Priyap In's execution by firing squad is not only filmed, but mandated to be shown in all of Cambodia's cinemas before a feature film is shown for an entire month. It was also printed on posters and put up in Cambodian schools. I'll quote Osborne here. Years later, Cambodians still spoke of the revulsion many had felt at the sight of the rebel's body, riddled with bullets, slumping at the execution stake. End quote. While Chandler notes, quote, it was often something that was spoken about in the 1980s when people began to ask when Sihanouk's decline may have started. End quote. Another kind of grim example of Sihanouk seemingly losing the plot a little bit occurs toward the end of November. So already we've had him piping up about the Khmer Serai broadcasts in the wake of Diem's assassination, then proclaiming the cessation of accepting US economic aid. And you know what? After a little bit of time in which the dust settled after Diem's assassination, Kennedy and his advisors do notice Sihanouk making a fuss, and even begin discussions on how to placate him. But, alas, in what is the beginning of 100 different historical counterfactuals, the interest that Kennedy showed in trying to prevent further deterioration in relations with Cambodia was left somewhat on the shelf, as Kennedy, too, was gunned down in Dallas on the 22nd of November. And it's actually Sihanouk's reaction to this that is pretty unsavory. I'll quote Osborne's biography of Sihanouk to show you. Quote, Sihanouk gave full vent, terming the late American president as the great boss, and he welcomed the deaths. Oh, when he says deaths here, Osborne is referring to not only Kennedy and Diem, but a Thai politician as well. So Sihanouk welcomed the deaths, said that the three would all meet in hell, and called on the population to celebrate the deaths of these foreign leaders by wearing red armbands and assembling to listen to music performances near the royal palace. End quote. So, again, that's not an ideal way for a head of state to sort of reflect upon the murder of other heads of state, but in the interest of balance, here is Sihanouk's own version of that particular November in 1963. Quote, incidentally, I must correct an error, which unfortunately was printed in the American press. I did, in fact, order 3 days of national celebrations when the detestable Saigon dictatorship ended. But, at the time of the assassination of President Kennedy, many of our shops displayed his portrait in their windows as a sign of respect. An unscrupulous American photographer asked a Cambodian passerby to pose and smile alongside one of the Kennedy portraits, and this was published in the USA with captions to the effect that in Cambodia there was official rejoicing over President Kennedy's death. An absurd slander. Later, I named a boulevard in Sihanoukville in his memory. End quote. So, you know, that's his version. I don't know, considering how much he left out of the story when it came to those Khmer Serai presented in cages, it's hard to trust him completely on this one, but whether it was a misunderstanding or not, in any case, what we are getting at here is the fast deteriorating relationship between the two countries. This is like one of those rope bridges that is hanging on by a thread, and various factions are seeking to cut the last remaining ties on either side. Or short of that, they're jumping up and down recklessly, seemingly unaware of the crocodiles that are lurking below. The US Embassy is seeing these actions on behalf of Sihanouk as neurotic, bizarre. It could be, as Chandler suggests, that the former king was actually suffering from fatigue and hypertension, as well as depression, linked to a battle with obesity, linked to a congenital diabetic condition, which might have also had something to do with trying to run Cambodia basically single-handedly. Further compounding this deterioration of relations between the two countries was that the very few trusted American diplomats that had been stationed in Cambodia had recently been replaced by ones that, well, in brief, they just weren't Sihanouk's kind of guys. There was a mutual distrust growing between the two parties. And in the case of the United States in particular, I mean, you might recall a few episodes ago when we referred to this idea of great state autism, this sort of way of describing some of the foreign policy relationships for a country like the US in this, you know, that they kind of don't understand the feelings of a nation like Cambodia. I'll quote Chandler here as he details this expertly. Quote, "The US Embassy perceived the conduct of foreign affairs as proceeding rationally along American lines. US officials also ignored the possibility that Sihanouk's neutralist policies might be less dangerous for Cambodia than a full-blown alliance with the United States." End quote. So what Chandler is getting at, there is this sort of complete lack of understanding as to why anyone would not just go along with what the US wanted. It was their way or the highway. By the end of 1963, the relationship is hanging on by just a thread. Meanwhile, the economic measures that Sihanouk had enacted, again, just to remind you, he had nationalized the banks, the import-export industry, and the big one was getting rid of US financial aid, which again was accounting for almost 20% of the entire Cambodian budget and a third of the military budget. Osborne says that these things might have been good in theory, but the abandonment of US aid crippled the budget, the nation's economy was put under strain, and a very powerful contingent of Cambodian society, those connected to the military, were disadvantaged. Watch that space. And I can't believe, like, literally, as I'm saying this, we've finally got to 1964. I feel like this entire year I've been writing about the early 60s, and there's just so much in 1963 to wade through. So I don't know how many hours we've been stuck in that year, but we can finally stretch our legs into 1964 a little, which is another huge year with a couple of key events, but more on the Vietnam side of things, and we'll briefly explore what they are in the next episode. And don't worry, if you're listening to this as it comes out, it's not going to be another 3 months. Apologies. But to sort of recenter on the story here, if we're only slightly nodding to the huge elephant in the room, that is the escalating conflict in Vietnam, let's wrap up Cambodia and this relationship with the US. Now, we've seen in previous episodes that Sihanouk has been rather prescient about this coming interaction between the US and the two Vietnams. He thinks the US will lose, just like the French. So we've seen him being slightly more friendly to the North Vietnamese, particularly in that sort of unwritten agreement of letting their troops, and now the Viet Cong, come across into Cambodian territory when necessary, in order to maintain their insurgency in South Vietnam. He is making no concessions to the United States on that. Why should he? Particularly when he felt he was being undermined by the CIA constantly, and that they might be plotting to, well, kill him. Not only does he allow the NLF to come into Cambodia when they need, but he signs an agreement with the North where he can skim off 10% of the military equipment coming from China to the NLF via the port of Sihanoukville. From the United States point of view, by 1964, those who were advocating for increased involvement in South Vietnam were definitely in the ascendancy. Again, we will explore that in the next episode, but with that in mind, Cambodia starts changing from a sort of unimportant distraction with a vaguely annoying leader into a genuinely unacceptable irritant. The difference between one of your teeth feeling a little weird when you eat a piece of candy and having a throbbing toothache keeping you up at night. Although the United States were not aware of all of the details, they correctly suspected that substantial quantities of supplies were reaching the communist forces in South Vietnam through Cambodia, with some degree of official permission. They also knew for certain that the NLF were beginning to use the border areas in Cambodia as safe havens to retreat toward and regroup. With this knowledge, or suspicion, they began to have very little sympathy with Sihanouk's claims that he was simply pursuing neutrality. And when Cambodians began complaining about South Vietnamese troops accompanied by the US military also beginning to enter into Cambodian territory to pursue the Viet Cong, well, the US are less inclined to care about that either. This will soon extend into the bombs that begin falling on these areas as well. Which brings us, actually, to 1965. May 1965, when Sihanouk finally announces that he is breaking up with the United States for reals this time. The international relations equivalent of telling an ex that you don't want to talk to them anymore and then raising that in 1965 to blocking their number. Well, why did this final straw break the camel's back? Well, we can point to a few things and ask a few different sources. We'll start with Sihanouk. Now he, and you can imagine why he puts it this way, again, written in 1973 when he was allied with the Khmer Rouge and waging a civil war against a United States-backed Cambodian regime. So he says that he spent many sleepless nights in May 1965. Because some peasants had been killed in the area of Cambodia known as the Parrot's Beak. They had been killed in an American bombing raid. He said that if there was any shred of national dignity to be preserved, he must sever the ties completely with the United States, which is very noble of him. Other sources, like Chandler, like Osborne, have a slightly more Sihanouk-esque reason for this final reason for the Cambodian leader to act in this manner. They both relay that in April 1965, so a month before the decision to completely sever ties, a couple of reports emerged in sort of US language papers, and the source apparently being a relatively close American translator to Sihanouk, that the former king, well, he had a number of concubines, so that's insult number one. They also said that Queen Cossamac, his mother, was, quote, money mad. And the third insult was that she owned a number of brothels at the edge of the city in Phnom Penh. Which one of these do we weigh more in Sihanouk's decision to completely sever ties with the US? Well, let's be charitable and say it was both. Either way, Sihanouk announces the cessation of relations with the US, something the Americans were expecting but not particularly bothered by. These relations would not be renewed for another 4 years. And quite a bit is going to happen in those 4 years. Things will be quite a lot worse by the time Sihanouk pushes the unblock button on WhatsApp and starts typing, "Hey, can we talk?" But already, my dear listener, you might be thinking about the other massive thing that was happening at the same time as Sihanouk calls it quits with the US. By May 1965, Operation Rolling Thunder had been underway for 2 months. Actual combat troops, no longer under the guise of advisors, had come ashore at Da Nang in early March. The Vietnam War had begun. And that's what we will be talking about next time on In the Shadows of Utopia, as well as Pol Pot's trips to Hanoi and Beijing and the coming Cambodian civil war. And again, if you're listening to this right now, thank you so much. Thank you to everyone who has supported the show. Thank you so much for waiting this long as well. Some of you listening might know why that it has taken so long for this to be released. This is the first episode written and released from the Northern Hemisphere, and I'm speaking to you from Mexico right now as opposed to Melbourne. Again, apologies if there are some hiccups in the audio that can happen when recording in a new place. Either way, happy to have this out, excited about the future. Hope everyone is well and happy. As always, thank you to Patreon supporters. Thank you for leaving reviews, those of you that have. And a big thank you to anyone that's reached out by email. It's been a great pleasure speaking to all of you. Until next time, everyone, goodbye.